Welcome to the Torah Te'imecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Hanalea Rappaport, and today we will be learning Sefer Shmuel Bey's Perek Yud Aleph. This Perek contains what is probably one of the most well-known stories in Tanakh. In Nach, it's the story of David and Bathsheba. It's probably the one that's least understood as well. It's going to be very, very difficult to do justice to this inyan in the very short period of time that I've been given. I start with the tefillah, Hashem sefasai tiftach ufi yagiti lesecha. Hashem, put the right words into my mouth so that I can give the proper respect to this very complex topic. Before starting, I just want to say the words of the Gemara. Kol ha'omer David chata einai ela toya. Whoever thinks that David sinned in this story is making a big mistake. So, however we're going to hear the story and learn through the story, we have to know that this is what the Gemara is telling us from the very start, from this beginning. I'm going to tell you the basic story, and then we're going to try and understand it both halachically and hashkafically. David sends Yoav and his soldiers to fight against Ammon. We learned in the last parak that there was some sort of battle between Ammon and the Jews, and David is going to take revenge. It's possible that David should have been at this battle. Some of the Mefarshim say that was the problem. Why was he at home? In any case, he was at home. He wakes up one night, goes to his porch, and he sees a woman bathing on her rooftop. The Gemara says, of course she must have had some sort of barrier blocking the view, but the Satan made himself into the form of a bird, and David, inexplicably, again, in the middle of the night, shoots at this bird, and the arrow, instead of hitting the bird, hits the mechitza, hits the barrier, bringing it down, and exposes her. Once he sees her, he calls for her, has relations with her, and sends her home. She lets him know that she's pregnant, and so David calls her husband to come back from the battlefield. When he arrives, David tries to convince him to go home to his wife, ostensibly to cover up his act. When Uriah refuses, David sends him back to battle with a letter asking Yoav, the general, to send him to the front lines where, predictably, Uriah is killed. Yoav sends a messenger back to David, telling him, the messenger, that if David gets upset that people were killed in battle, don't worry, just tell him that Uriah was also killed. And indeed, when David hears the news, he tells the messenger, don't worry, people often get killed in war. He waits for Bathsheba, Uriah's widow, to complete her mourning, and then brings her into his home, marries her, and she has a child, their son. And the matter, the Navi ends, was ra be'enei Hashem. It was bad, it was evil in the eyes of Hashem. That's the story, and we need to understand what happened here. Can it be that we'll understand this as the simple reading of the story? Is it possible that David Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayim, our hero, our king, the writer of our Tehillim that accompanies us through our days, the father of Shlomo HaMelech who's going to build the Beis HaMikdash and be the progenitor of Mashiach, is he actually guilty of both adultery and murder? So there are some, like the Abar Bernal, who say that yes, we do have to take the story at face value. David did sin, and he did tshuva, and he acts for us as the model of a person who has sinned in a way that would seem to be that there's no return from, and yet he does come back, and he is the model of tshuva for individuals, the same way that the Jews were able to come back from Chet HaEgel and still be Hashem's nation, teaching us as a nation that there's always a return. David does the same for an individual, does tshuva, and teaches us that we can always do tshuva. However, most vehemently disagree. And they say, was there a sin here? Yes, there was a sin here, otherwise David would not have spent the rest of his life doing tshuva, as we'll see through so many prakim of Tehillim, that he is doing tshuva for this act. And Hashem would not have to send, like he will in the next parak Nasan Hanavi, to chastise him. And so many of the things that are going to happen now till the end of the Sefer are a response to this act. So obviously something happened, but what the Gemara is saying is, anyone who thinks that David sinned the way it is written on pshat level is making a terrible mistake. There was a sin here, but it was not adultery, and it was not murder. And there's going to be many proofs along the way that this could not have been the way that it looks like as it says it in the Nach. Nothing would make sense if it is like it sounds. On the most basic level, if David is doing tshuva, then he would have to know the halacha. The halacha is that if a person commits adultery with a woman, even if the woman's circumstances change afterwards, for example, even if she gets divorced from her husband, that man who committed adultery with her is never allowed to marry her, meaning they're never allowed to be together. So if David actually does sincere tshuva, how is he bringing her back into his house? How is he living with her in sin if he's doing tshuva for his action? Why would he daven for his child, for their son, as we'll see that he does, if the son was conceived in sin through adultery? How could it be that they stay together, David and Bathsheba? They have another son whose name is going to be Shlomo, about whom it is said that Hashem loved him from birth. And Dafka, this son, out of all of David's son, is going to be chosen to build the Beis HaMikdash. Again, this could not have happened if she was an Eshes Ish, if this act was an act of adultery. So it cannot be that this act was adultery. So then what justification could there possibly be for his actions? How could he possibly have seen a woman on a rooftop and taken her, knowing that she was married to someone else? What could possibly have caused him to do such a thing? And even if we don't remember every single detail of the tests that David has been through, we certainly remember some. We know that he is not and has never been impulsive. We know that he is the one who had opportunities to kill Shaul HaMelech, who is trying to kill him. He's standing in the cave with Shaul, and yet he does not kill him. He has to deal in Shmuel Beis with Yoav, almost upsetting his whole melucha, and he does not take action. And so many incidents that he thinks through everything, even as recently as a story that he is waiting to hear the whispering in the trees and he's not going to go and kill the plishtim until he hears those whispers. And yet seeing a woman bathing would cause him to jump into an adulterous relationship? What is this? So I'll give you some introductions. Again, very brief, way too briefly, without enough meat on this to make it as satisfactory for me or probably for you, but I'll do the best I can. David's whole mahus, the essence of his being, was to find a resting place for the Shechina, to build the Beis HaMikdash. Everything in his life is going to be revolving around building the Beis HaMikdash. And David knows, Baruch HaKadosh, that the son who's going to build the Beis HaMikdash has not been born yet. And he knows, Baruch HaKodesh, once he sees Bathsheba, she is the one who's going to be the mother of this chain through whom Mashiach is going to come. And this is his entire desire. I need to find a resting place for the Shechina. I need to be Marba Kvayt Shemaim. I need to expand Hashem's presence in this world. And he's getting older. And I have no idea who's going to be the next king after me. And it says, Darash Rava. Rava says, Ru'uya haisa Bathsheba l'David misheshes yemei bereshes. He was right, David. Bathsheba really was his identified wife. From the time that the world was created, it was preordained that David and Bathsheba were going to be together and create the house of Mashiach. But what? Says Rava. Ella sha'achla paga. Meaning he did it prematurely. And it was too early. It was not at the right time. And that was the mistake here. His mistake was not marrying Bathsheba. He was supposed to marry Bathsheba, but he did it at the wrong time. And there seems to be something unnatural pushing him through these events. And we have to look a little bit at David HaMelech's history. Where does David come from? And it seems like there is a very murky past. There are many, many relationships that have happened in David HaMelech's past, which are so unusual and so aberrant from the way that we look at any Jew, never mind the Yidden who are building Mashiach's house. So we start off with the Benois Light, meaning it's the children of Light once Sodom is destroyed, and Light thinks he is alone in the world and he has relationships with his daughters. Through these relationships, the nations of Moab and Ammon are born. That's on David's great-grandmother's side, because one of the children that's going to be born from Light, from Moab, is Ruth, and Ruth is going to marry Boaz, also in a very unnatural scenario where where she is, first of all, a Gioris from a nation that's unclear whether we're allowed to accept converts from. And she's going to go to a granary in the middle of the night. Again, no time to go into the whole story of Ruth and Boaz, but also would have hours of what to say about it. But in the middle of the night, she goes to the granary to tell Boaz, I need you to marry me. Boaz is indeed going to marry Ruth and then die the next day, but from this is going to create the grandfather of David HaMelech. And then, of course, from his father's side, from the family of Yehuda, where does that come from? Well, Yehuda meets Tamar, who's again, ostensibly a prostitute sitting on the crossroads, and a malach pushes him to have relationships with her. And through that, Tamar almost is going to lose her life when it's discovered that she is pregnant. But Yehuda is going to have to admit, no, this was me. And twins are going to be born from here. And through that, David HaMelech, again, from his paternal side, is coming. There is so much that is unclear about the past of David, and he must know this history, meaning he knows where he comes from. He knows the history of Yehuda and Tamar. He knows the history of Boaz and Ruth. And he knows that both all of them are highly compromised situations. And he knows that Yehuda was meant to marry Tamar. He knows that was meant to happen. It was good to happen. He knows that Boaz was meant to marry Ruth, even though many naysayers had what to say about it. Many people were talking about it. These highly compromised situations, and yet the right choice was to do what seemed to be wrong. And perhaps he thought, when he saw Bathsheba up there on the roof, if I'm seeing her and I'm being pushed to take her, is it not possible that this is part of the route through where Mashiach has to come? Now, this begs another question of why does Mashiach have to come through such murky routes? Meaning, why can't there be pure, pristine yichus? Why can't we be able to look back in the family tree and say, this is a family that nothing wrong ever happened. This is a pristine family. And again, very briefly, it says that a king has to have the proverbial skeleton in his closet. There has to be no gaiva. A king has to come from a place where he knows that there are, that I am but a servant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's not about me, and it's not about the family that I come from. Everybody has a skeleton in their closet. Everyone has things. And the more gaiva a person has, and sometimes, and perhaps even Shaul, about whom he was described that he was a head taller than everyone around him, he had no skeleton in his closet. His family was a pure family. A king, David, the person who's going to be only reflect the Shechina of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's good for him to come to from a place where there's not one but many skeletons in his closet. And more so, and again, this is going, I'm saying something very deep, very briefly. The Satan is looking to destroy Kedusha, and he seeks out the Kedusha. And when someone makes a big deal about himself and his covet, he's an easy target. But Mashiach has to be protected. And so the Satan isn't necessarily going to notice or care about a father like Light impregnating his daughters, or a poor woman who's been illegally married to a dishonored person who her first, Ruth's first husband was a dishonored person, working in the fields and now going into the granary. So the Satan didn't notice these acts happening, allowing them to happen to bring Mashiach there. But in David's mind, perhaps this was his nisayon. Should I do something that looks to be so wrong because perhaps it's so right, like my father, my ancestors did? And lastly, last point before we go into the story, it is the derech of Tanakh to write things in the worst possible way. HaKadosh Baruch Hu medaktek im tzadikim k'chut hasara. It means that when it says sins by our people in Tanakh, we have to know that the words that are being used may be the same words that we use, but they are entirely different. As a mashal, you have a big piece of scrap metal, an abandoned car, perhaps, and you say there's a scratch on the car, and then you have a very expensive, exquisite diamond, and then you say there's a scratch on the diamond. We're saying the same word, scratch, and yet it means entirely different things. We have an example back in Sefer Yehoshua, where one person stole from the spoils of the city of Jericho. And the Navi says that Hashem says, Klal Yisrael, the whole Jewish nation, they stole and they hid and they denied and they put it in their bags. And we are talking about one person taking very few items, and yet it looks disastrous. So we have to know also that our forefathers are judged on a very, very stringent level. Okay, let's go to the story now. Again, very briefly. Once David HaMelech sees her, he understands that there is no way that I would have been nichshal, that this thing would have happened to me, to see a woman bathing, if there was not a purpose to it. And perhaps the purpose is that I should be marrying her. Otherwise, why would I see her? And so he brings her to his palace. Now, the basic halachic linchpin on which this whole story stands, and we know this as a fact historically, is that in the time of David, when people would go to war, they would write a get. They would conditionally divorce their wives in case they did not come back. Today we have dog tags. Then they didn't. Meaning, if a person died in battle, there was a very good chance that no one would know that he was actually dying. Nobody would be able to prove it, or there wouldn't be a body to bring back. And therefore, many women would be left unable to marry other people after a war. So any soldier who went out gave his wife a conditional get. Now, conditional is a question, meaning there are many discussions about what the condition is. So perhaps the condition is that if he came back from battle, then they wouldn't need to get remarried, because it was just conditional on if he doesn't come back, then it is a get. And perhaps David, as a king, knew he had it in his control that this condition would never happen, meaning he had it in his control that Uriah was never going to come back, which meant that this get, this divorce, was not a conditional one at this point, because there was a divorce here. And the divorce was only conditional on Uriah coming back, and if need be, Uriah wouldn't come back. That's one way of understanding it. According to others, it was a real get. It was an actual get. There wasn't a suffix. It wasn't conditional. There was an actual divorce that happened here, and they would rescind the divorce once the husband came back, but it was an actual divorce. Either way, at the time that David was with Uriah, with Bathsheba, and Uriah was at the battlefield, Bathsheba was not a married woman. She had been divorced from her husband. Conditionally, unconditionally, whatever it was, she was divorced. Therefore, there was no adultery here, answering so many of the questions. David sends his messengers to bring her to the palace, to bring her to his palace. This is probably the biggest indicator that he was convinced that he wasn't doing anything wrong. If he's going to get involved with someone else's wife, he would not have done so publicly. So he sends his messengers telling us that he didn't think there was a mistake in what he was doing at this point. And another interesting point, which indicates to us that this couldn't have been adultery, is that the pasuk makes a point of telling us that the bathing she was doing was in a mikvah, to purify herself from being a nida. If this was an act of an adultery, do we really care about this detail, if she was a nida or not a nida? There are many other problems that we have. So if the pasuk is making a point of telling us she is not a nida, then that also indicates to us that this was not adultery. A side point, why would she be miskadeshes mitumasa? Why would she be going to the mikvah if her husband was at war? So we have to know that in those days, people were much more aware of tuma and tara. There are many more implications for it. And women made sure to keep themselves in a state of tahara. Even young girls at that time went to the mikvah. He sends her back, possibly because he wants it to be clear to all that she's not going to go back to Uriah. And then when he takes her, it's going to be a legitimate taking of her. The hardest part of the story to reconcile is David bringing Uriah back once he heard that Bathsheba was pregnant. There are many lengthy discussions, which time does not allow me to go into, but in short, it seems that David, at this point, once he hears that Bathsheba is pregnant, is trying to avoid Achil Hashem. And what is interesting is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not allow this to happen, meaning in the end, everyone is going to know this story. Everyone even knows about the secret letter that David sends to Yoav, which never would have had to come out to the public if the Navi wouldn't have recorded it forever. Indeed, these psukim are missing from Divrei HaYamim, as we spoke about yesterday, and the whole story could have remained buried. Like, meaning, the fact that we know about David and Bathsheba is only because Hashem wanted us to know about it. Chazal say, Kol ha-mechal shem shamayim b'seser nifra'en mimenu b'galoi. Meaning that don't think that you're going to avoid a chil Hashem here, David. This is not the way that we avoid chil Hashem. Hashem does not want us to use dishonesty to avoid a chil Hashem. So it's to let us know forever that we're not supposed to do it. And perhaps all this comes to be public, so that we should know what happened and to learn from the tshuva of David forever. A gift for us forever is to know how David does tshuva. Ultimately, the fact that Uriah refuses to go back home was a big gift for David, because had he gone home, there would have been many, many complicated halachas regarding the get that was given. And in this way, it's clear that no adultery ever happened because Uriah refuses to go home. More so, when Uriah refuses to go home, he does it in a very disrespectful way. He sleeps outside with the servants, so it was a public defiance. I am not going home. When David tries again, Uriah says, I should go home when my master Yoav is fighting. My master Yoav, you're saying to David, to the king is telling you to do something and you're pulling a higher master than the king. And Uriah swears, I will not do so. And he swears in the name of, he does not swear in the name of the king, which is what he should be doing if he's standing before the king. And now he is considered a marid b'malchus, somebody who is defiant of the king. And when a person is defiant of the king of marid b'malchus, the king has a right, no, he has an obligation to kill that person. Meaning a person is not allowed to be defiant of a king. And so David sends this letter to Uriah, which is dangerous because Uriah could open it or Yoav could refuse to carry it out, but he does send this letter to Uriah. And the instruction to have Uriah killed, this is where David makes a mistake. This is the biggest mistake in the whole parsha. A king is technically allowed to put anyone anywhere he wants in the battlefield, and people have no choice but to do what the king tells them to do. We're allowed to do, a king is allowed to do that. However, the thing which drives the king's decisions should be considerations of security and not personal considerations. And the Gemara says that his mistake, the mistake that David made, was not having Uriah killed, because Uriah should have been killed, because he was a marid b'malchus, he was defiant of the king. But he should have brought him to Sanhedrin to have him, to have a clear ruling that he was a marid b'malchus. Because this was the mistake, was David's personal considerations here in having Uriah killed. Perhaps David was trying to put the final decision in Hashem's hands, meaning Hashem could save him from the battlefield and then I'll know that he's not meant to die. But if we're looking for where David is going to do tshuva, David is going to do tshuva on this, and the Navi will say it later, because of what happened with Uriah. It's interesting, when the Navi says that what David is going to do tshuva about, he doesn't say that he took Bathsheba. It seems like the taking of Bathsheba was not, this was not an adulterous relationship, nor was it murder. The problem was, again, to be clear, having Uriah killed in battlefield in this way without first consulting with the Sanhedrin. It seems interesting that we don't see a public reaction to David taking Bathsheba, and it seems like the people were able to justify what happened because of Uriah's behavior when he came back to Yerushalayim was so publicly against the king that they understood what happened. However, it was ra be'enei Hashem. Even if nobody heard about it, it still would have been ra be'enei Hashem. Again, much, much more to say on this topic, much more to understand on this topic, and I would suggest there are sources that can be read and more that can be discovered. I gave you the brief highlights, and I hope I did a satisfactory job in explaining this very complex topic. We will continue to deal with it through the next prokem. Thank you for studying together. Le'ilui nishmot imhotenu hayikarot, Esther Oppenheimer, Allah HaShalom, and Sarah Schenker, Allah HaShalom, each deeply devoted and proud to transmit their family's Torah legacy to the next generations.